Hello and welcome to the DC Insider Employer Update Podcast. This podcast updates you with the expertise and current insight of the Washington, D.C.-based attorneys from the Fortney Scott Law Firm. Each episode highlights the most important issues and analysis that employers need to know in order to understand and react to key federal developments affecting their business. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as legal advice on any subject matter. Now let's turn it over to our host, David Fortney.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Fortney, and welcome to another DC Insider What Employers Need to Know podcast. I'm really pleased to have joining me today both Bert Fishman. Bert, you want to say hey?
Hi, David. Hi, everybody. I'm glad to be back.
Bert, we're glad to have you back. And also Nita Beecher. Hi, Nita.
Hi, David. Hi, Bert. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm really glad to have both of you. And gosh, we've got so much to cover. And we really want to focus on the rapidly evolving, or devolving, perhaps we should say, situation involving COVID. Really, we're recording this now on August 5th, and I want to date stamp that because things are changing so rapidly. But in the last 10 days or so, not even 2 weeks, but 10, 12 days, the ground has really started to shift rapidly. And what we want to do is try to unpack that a little bit and focus on some of these significant changes that particularly the federal contractors, but the employer community is now grappling with. We've seen the administration respond. We've gone from 4th of July, we're all going to be happy and out there and maskless, to within less than 30 days, now we have the variant, and particularly the Delta variant. We have massive new efforts, local, state, and the federal efforts to effectively reboot, to rewind, and to try to invoke, once again, not full lockdowns, at least modifications and additional requirements. And not surprisingly, many, many segments of the population are not real happy about having to go backwards. So we want to really unpack those issues a little bit, spend a little bit of time talking about that. But Nita, you took a road trip. And so I don't know whether you deserve a medal for valor or you need to we need to rethink about your mental acumen. But you went on a big road trip. You're in the U.S. And tell us where you were and what your impressions were, because you're our in-the-field reporter.
I am also in the Midwest where COVID is raging right now. All our hospitals here in Missouri, I'm in St. Louis. Politicians are saying we're not going to do any masking. I was in the state of Tennessee in the middle of what was supposed to be the biggest concert weekend in Tennessee. They had 200,000 seat arenas full Saturday night. And if you saw a mask, it was in somebody's pocket. And clearly, America, at least in the part of America where I live, is not ready to go back to masks and mandates and that type of thing. I was at the National Industrial Liaison Conference for the first time in 2 years. It is the largest EEO conference in the country, especially for those of us who deal with federal contractors. And while we were on one floor pretty much by ourselves, we were unmasked. But as soon as we went down into the hotel or into restaurants, we were masking up because it was unclear who was vaccinated and who wasn't. So I think the CDC guidance allowing people to take masks off was, it seems to have backfired on all of us, at least at this point. And I think, David, at this point, what we're seeing, and I think as we lead into where the president spoke a couple of weeks ago, there has been a 64% increase in COVID cases since the end of July. 97% of those that are in the hospital, that are getting sick, that are being reported, are unvaccinated. However, wow, there's some pretty substantial breakthrough COVID as we have run into in our own office. And people were very concerned at the ILG about the possibility, even though most of us, if not all of us, were vaccinated. So, Bert, passing this off to you, I understand that the president is trying to do something about this.
Thanks, Nita. And yes, indeed, it's pretty clear that the resurgence of the vaccine and the persistence of the resistance has kind of caught the Biden administration by surprise, and they're struggling to try to come to terms with it. The most significant, and really it's quite a change, was an announcement by the president in a fact sheet, which is probably soon to be an executive order, that instructs every federal government employee and every federal contractor who works in a government building on site, and soon now the military, will be asked to attest to their vaccination status. Anyone who does not make that attestation will be required to wear a mask on the job, no matter where they are. Geographic location is irrelevant. They must physically distance, and from all other employees, even from visitors, they have to get weekly or twice weekly screening, and they'll be subject to travel restrictions. So it's really get a vaccination or live with these onerous burdens. Now, the rules so far apply to federal workers and on-site contractors, but the president has announced that he is directing his team to take steps to apply similar standards to all federal contractors, and that's hundreds of thousands of private sector employees. And the administration obviously continues to jawbone to encourage employers in the private sector to follow this model. And just to give you a sense of the scope, we're talking about 4 million people, 2 million of whom are federal employees and 2 million of whom are in the military. But David, why don't you talk about the implications of this for federal contractors?
Sure, because it's one thing for the president and the leaders in Washington to say, let's impose these more rigorous standards, which isn't a full-blown vaccine mandate, but it's effectively trying to make being not vaccinated sufficiently inconvenient, enough of a pain in the neck that you want to get vaccinated, and that which is one of the new evolving strategies. But moving from having the president simply announce that this is what he wants to achieve and imposing those requirements has a multitude of steps and obligations for federal contractors. And most of our clients are federal contractors. And as they're looking at this announcement, we don't yet have the language of an executive order. We don't yet have the language of the regulations that will implement these requirements in the federal acquisition regulations or the FAR or DFAR. So all those details, all of which are critical, are still forthcoming. And so we expect within the next week or two, we're going to get those. But even today, as contractors begin to triage, how are we going to meet these new requirements? For example, most workforces, you may be embedded in a site, a specific site. You may be an operator of a GOCO, as it's called, government-owned, contract-operated facility. There are a lot of those. Or you may have employees that are in and out of a site. They come in to do maintenance work. They come in to do various specialized work and then leave. How are you going to figure out how to move from where you are today to meeting these sorts of new requirements? Obviously, you have to start by surveying your own workforce and then to begin to develop an implementation plan on how that's going to move forward in receiving vaccines, who's vaccinated, who's not. What if you have a large block of people that are not vaccinated, but they're critical at a customer or contract site? How do you go about dealing with that? So that's kind of the jumping off point that where it begins. And Nita, I know you've looked at some of the other kind of nuts and bolts of some of these staffing questions.
Well, one of the real issues is who is going to be considered on site. And honestly, if talking to federal contractors at the National Industrial Liaison Conference, in fact, several of our clients were there, they want to know as soon as possible, what are we going to have to do for those employees who go, let's say, to a base where they work or who go to other federal sites? And I think your point, David, is a really good one. What are you going to do with people who, for example, the trucks that bring the supplies in and drop them off from the warehouse where the federal contractor keeps them? That's another place we're going to have to figure it out. I would almost suggest, and I throw this back to you all, that federal contractors, if they're going to have to do this for all of their workforce that works on federal contracts, they might as well start figuring out that plan, understanding that the on-site people are going to be first. But go ahead and figure out how you're going to handle this for all of your employees that are on contracts and then kind of go from there. But, you know, Bert, some of these are heavily unionized and what do they have to do?
Well, I'm glad you raised it because, you know, people talk about issues from the White House without realizing that all of the unionized facility, including federal employees, that, you know, you have a duty to bargain about this stuff. And we can already hear there have been objections and questions about exactly the things you've mentioned, how it's going to be implemented. When's it going to happen? Unions are kind of upset that they weren't involved in the formulation of this. As you might expect, unions are split. The AFL and the AFT seem to have voiced support for this kind of an operation, a kind of quasi-mandate. Police, firefighters, and service employees are vocally opposed. And even within the unions, the two largest service unions, 1199 in New York, is holding back. SEIU in California, which is 300,000 workers, are for it. The UFCW, which is all of the food and commercial workers, they are now formally opposed until they bargain. So all you federal contractors, whether you're unionized or not, start talking to your labor lawyers about the effects bargaining, about mandatory subjects of bargaining, or exactly what Nita just talked about. How do you prepare to implement what is certain to be coming down the road for you?
Right. And I just want to underscore what Bert just said about talking to your labor council, checking your CBA. Your management rights clause likely will not give you a full green light. So even though the government's told you to impose these new obligations on you, rather, you still have to bargain, perhaps decision effects, as Bert indicated.
I remember when I was with McDonnell Douglas, they implemented the drug requirements, the mandatory drug testing and all of that. And we had to negotiate with all five unions on site.
Right. And as we all know, that takes a little bit of time. So, you know, I think that the well-counseled, thoughtful contractors are beginning to put those puzzle pieces together and developing their own labor strategy on how they go about that. What about what's chargeable, Nita? You've lived with McDonnell Douglas. How do you, what does the government pick up and what do the companies have to absorb?
Well, and that's a big question. I mean, you need to get with your procurement folks and your contracts lawyers to start figuring that out. What can you charge back? Now, if you have your employees go out and encourage them to go ahead and get vaccinated right now, but the question is going to be, David, for those who are not vaccinated, the time it takes to test them, you know, masking them and all that stuff, how often are you going to test them? Where are you going to test them? And then remember back, way back in the dark ages, the EEOC put down guidelines about all of the requirements around the ADA, because that's all medical information. And if you bring in your own people to do the testing of those employees, you're going to have to treat that as medical information and also keep the identity of those employees. So, I mean, it's very complicated once you get to that point. And then, David, I think the next question is, who's going to pay for the vaccines and the time incurred to take it?
Because in addition to these EEO considerations and whether it's chargeable under the contract, there's still a question of the vaccine. Now, at this point, we've evolved to the point that basically federal government, all of us as taxpayers, we're paying for the vaccine in most cases. But there still is a question about the time incurred. If you have a mandated series of actions that the employee has to take, they have to go to a vaccination center, or you have the vaccination center on site and they have to wait, you know, 30 minutes and an appointment. And that all is potentially compensable time. Even if it's not compensable under federal law, reminder, please make sure you look under applicable state law, employers, as you're devising this. What many employers are beginning to do, rather than trying to keep track of people clocking in, they're paying them a stipend that represents a generous estimation as to what the time is that's incurred. And they indicate that the stipend covers up to 60 minutes of time or 90 minutes of time in order to secure the vaccination. And it advises people, if for some reason your situation takes longer, let us know and we can pay for it. You may trigger overtime that week also. So all those kind of, I'll call it blocking and tackling, nuts and bolts type issues on overtime, compensability of activity, also need to be reviewed as you're implementing these new vaccination requirements.
You know, David, all of those concerns are not just limited to the government employees and to federal contractors. The dam has burst, and I think we can see that the whole private sector is starting to respond in much the way the federal government is, and even further with mandatory vaccines, mandatory testing, and if not vaccines, then masking, social distancing, and all other kinds of restrictions as an alternative. And I know that recently, we've been talking, David, about the legal implications of can you do it? Is it permissible? EUA versus formal approval. And there was a recent Office of Legal Counsel, an opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel, that perhaps you can fill us in on.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So this goes back to a point that we have covered several times on our discussions about whether this emergency use authorization that all of the vaccinations have been operating under, which allowed the vaccinations to be deployed much more quickly as opposed to a full authorization, whether the EUA, as Bert just referenced, precludes employers from mandating. How can you mandate something that's been given an emergency use approval, which, by the way, one of the terms is it's supposed to be voluntary? So the Office of Legal Counsel, that's kind of the brain trust within the Justice Department, okay? They're the ones that sort of divine what the law is and apprise the entire executive branch and the general public, this is what we think the law is. They dealt with this issue very specifically. And again, as part of the rollout last week of some of this new guidance by the Biden administration, the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel issued a very detailed 34-page opinion going through why an EUA, an emergency use authorization, does not preclude a vaccine mandate. So you can sort of check that box. The emergency use authorization allows a mandate to be imposed for vaccinations. Number two, was there some ADA issue? And again, they sort of looked and said, well, the EEOC has already answered that for us. So we don't think there's a Title VII or ADA issue either. So that teed up the issue very nicely. And the courts have largely been already moving in this direction, even without the benefit of this new OLC opinion. I want to just highlight the Seventh Circuit recently affirmed there was some litigation brought by students at Indiana University. You can't impose a mandate on me. And the Seventh Circuit Judge Easterbrook, fairly conservative, well-known judge, said, you don't have any constitutional right not to take a vaccination or to refuse that. That's not in the Constitution. Absolutely not. The university can certainly impose this requirement. So courts have sort of given these arguments and objections kind of the back of the hand so far. So I think it really now is becoming more for employer willingness to impose the vaccine and maybe the labor issues and workforce issues, but that has become the issue.
David, if I could just add a kind of inside baseball, Judge Easterbrook is now probably the most respected jurist on these Administrative Procedure Act sort of stuff. So this will be a very, very important opinion.
Yes, he is. He's kind of a Scalia acolyte and very highly regarded, particularly within the conservative circles. Well, Nita, talking about some of these other sort of practical values employers are grappling with. So we've got a lot of the legal underbrush and roadblocks kind of cleared out largely. What else are we looking at?
I wonder if that really did that. The president's statements, as well as this opinion, has kind of cleared out the underbrush and employers are just moving forward. Tyson's, a little bit surprisingly, announced just, I think, Monday that all of its employees, all, will be required to be vaccinated. Now, understand that Tyson's has been subject to a number of wrongful death lawsuits over people who died as a result of getting COVID or transmitting COVID to families from their meatpacking plants. Walmart also announced only their headquarters people, although they have gone back to requiring their employees to wear masks. Broadway, theaters, concert halls have now kind of gone over the vaccine edge, going to require vaccines or you don't get in. Microsoft, employees, vendors, as well as guests. Google, all employees in the office. Facebook, all the employees in the office. The one thing we are seeing is those employers who have unions, where GM, Caterpillar, GE are seeming to go mask first. They're mandating masks and they are talking to their unions, but at this point they have not mandated vaccines. Banks, we've got, again, they're saying if you're in the office, you have to be vaccinated. And I think most universities, back to your point about the Indiana decision, I think almost every university and college who doesn't have some other reason not to, is requiring students, staff, and faculty to be vaccinated. So it's a landslide at this point, David.
Well, let's talk for a moment about what issues these raise that employers really need to be thinking about. We've got this sea change that's occurred very rapidly cleared out the legal underbrush and a lot of companies are moving forward. I think that one practical point, and it depends on which sector you're in, we're in an extremely tight labor market, unusually tight. And therefore, employers' ability to impose mandates, particularly for critical employees would say, no, thank you. I'm not going to agree to that when your competitor does not impose a mandate. Are you going to lose that critical employee? Will they simply quit? There are growing examples where employees are saying, if you're going to require me to be vaccinated, I'm out of here. And I think that has a bit of a chilling impact, particularly for employers that have critically skilled workforce that they've invested in training. Losing those to a mask mandate, it will inhibit the ability to fully implement that type of mandate.
The other thing we're seeing, David, is honestly that they're saying, well, if you're going to require me to be vaccinated to come into the office, I'm just going to work from home. And I think you're going to see that. Secondarily, I think the other thing that employers really need to think about as they think about these vaccine mandates, as well as mask mandates, is how are they going to handle the requirements to accommodate? There was a very interesting question and answer series with EEOC Chair Burroughs at the ILG meeting this week, in which she was asked how to handle people who suddenly have to have a religious objection to vaccines. And she basically said, carefully, you do it on an individualized basis. You can look behind it. But all of that requires employers to get those processes set up and to do them properly. And I think, David, the last thing is, how does all of this impact OSHA and the obligations of employers under OSHA?
Right. And I think that's kind of a point that doesn't receive enough attention, honestly. So employers, recall, most employers, you're subject to the general duty clause. We do have the emergency temporary standard that imposes specific obligations for those high-risk industries, principally healthcare. And there's been certainly a step up of OSHA enforcement, predominantly where the Delta variant outbreaks are occurring in the South. But the general duty applies, if you will, to all employers subject to OSHA. And the obligations under the general duty change. Every time the CDC guidance changes, your general duty changes. So the new enhanced masking requirement now applies under the general duty. I think that's part of the reason why some of those mask changes that Nita described earlier have been imposed. Those are employers that are carefully following and tracking and changing their compliance program to comport with OSHA. So I think that's one thing. Second point I want to mention on OSHA, they have initially had published two lists for the emergency temporary standard. One was the highest risk industries, meatpacking, healthcare, retail, big box retail. And then there was a secondary list that was very broad manufacturing, a number of sites. OSHA very quietly dropped the whole second list. So the Biden administration's OSHA department has walked away from the focus on those industries and is going to limit just to those so-called the highest of high risk.
You know, I think, David, on the OSHA front, we're seeing the inevitable result of a department that has been completely depleted. I think the whole point that Secretary Walsh, his first issue was restaffing OSHA. And I think the reason they dropped the second list was they just don't have the manpower.
I think that's right. But nonetheless, the OSHA and the general duty for most employers and those that still remain in the high risk are getting visited by OSHA frequently now. They don't require a complaint. They can come on site. And so, you know, you need to be alert to that if you're in those high-risk industries. All right, let's step out here with a couple of key takeaways that we want to make sure that our listeners keep in mind as they move forward. So, Bert, do you want to start that, please?
Yeah, kind of repetitious. The dam is burst. States and local jurisdictions are responding to an altered situation, and they're doing so in some unexpected as well as some expected places. California and New York are adopting vaccine mandates. New Mexico, Ohio, Kentucky, cities in Alabama are offering incentives, mask mandates. Mind you, there are still some resistors, Texas and Florida, banning mandates. They're getting a lot of blowback. But I think the general trend now is that we're going to see more mask mandates and even more vaccine mandates.
Nita.
I think the bottom line is federal contractors in particular need to get their act together, get their procedures together, because vaccine mandates are coming.
And then I'll just end with the mandate question, just to remind people, in the United States, we cannot impose a single federal mandate. Under federalism concepts, this is still left to the states. But I think the breaking story is that so many of these states that had been anti-vax, anti-mask, they're getting religion. whether it be in Louisiana, Arkansas. Bert, you mentioned Florida and Texas. They still are there, but these are going to become, I believe, more of anti-vax deserts. And as industry and the rest of America generally, in almost a stampede that we're beginning to feel, develops and adopts vaccination requirements and gets used to that, I think that those are going to become true outliers. So we've covered a lot today. Vaccinations are hot. And I'm glad we had a chance to kind of get our arms around all of these developments. I do want to give a shout out to what our next session is going to be, because in about 2 weeks, we're going to drop another podcast after this one. And we're going to be focusing on what's been going on the Hill. We haven't forgotten that. There's been so much going on this summer. We're actually waiting to see what the Hill gets done. And it looks like they're on the verge of getting a lot done, whether it's infrastructure, Build Back Better, a whole range of issues, as well as some key confirmations. So we want to revisit, do an update for the end of August to talk about that. But as of today, employers, stay tuned, keep on top of these vaccination mandates because they're happening quickly. And I want to thank both Bert and Nita. It's been super being with you guys again.
Pleasure. Glad to be here.
Same.
So for all of you out there, we appreciate you listening to us today. You can subscribe to us. You can go on Spotify or your Apple Podcast or whatever your favorite provider is. And we look forward to continuing these discussions in the future and keeping everyone up to date. Again, thanks so much.
Thanks, everyone. We look forward to the next update. For those that would like to connect with any of the lawyers from Fortney Scott, please reach out to them directly by visiting fortneyscott.com. On the website, you can also listen to previous podcast episodes, as well as pick up your copy of the DC Insider Report and sign up for future updates. Thanks so much for listening.